tonight on Arena. Film reviews including Anemone and Die My Love, Bryce Dessner on his new cello concerto, and the documentary Celtic Utopia. Welcome along to Thursday Night's Arena. You can text us on 51551 as usual, arena@rte.ie, and you'll find us on Instagram at @rte_arena. It's Thursday night, time to take a seat at the movies on Arena. First up, Anemone, three-time Academy Award winner Daniel Day-Lewis makes a long-awaited return to the screen in a dark psychological drama co-written by the actor and his eldest son, Ronan, and it also stars Sean Bean. Oscar winner Jennifer Lawrence returns to the screen in Die My Love. She stars as Grace, a young mum who spirals into postnatal depression following the birth of her child. Robert Pattinson plays her partner. And finally, Alan Bennett's comedy drama The Choral. Ralph Fiennes plays a choirmaster arriving in a Yorkshire village as its brave young men head off to the Great War, and the Choral Society musters every ounce of energy to perform Elgar's oratorio. Arlene Hunt and Declan Burke are here after their trip to the cinema for us. We'll start with Anemone, the return of Daniel Day-Lewis to the big screen after 8 years. Declan, how big a deal is it for Daniel Day-Lewis to be back on the big screen?
Personally, I think it's huge. And it took about 10 minutes to realise what a loss he has been for the last 8 years. He allegedly retired. He says now that he didn't retire. He was taking a sabbatical. But he used to take quite lengthy periods of time between his films anyway. Rick, it's 8 years since Phantom Thread, as you say, but it was 5 years previous to that that he had done Lincoln. So, yeah, not that much of a difference. Terrific. I mean, even in the opening glimpses of him, we see him, he's living as a hermit. He plays a character called Ray, who's ex-British Army, and he's living as a hermit in a forest in Northern England. And the early moments of the film, we see him kind of flitting through the trees. We don't get to see his face. All we're getting is a sense of his physical presence. He's kind of like hunched over and wiry and kind of very, very tense. And you can almost feel it coming off the screen already. And then once we do get a glimpse of his face, the first full frontal of his face, it's in the eyes, just with this dark mischief radiating off him, and you kind of sit back in the seat and go, great, Daniel Day-Lewis is back.
Arlene, where are Jem and Ray at the start of this film? Because it's a film about brotherhood.
It is. And fatherhood, I would have said as well. So Jem is Ray's older brother, who is also a squaddy. Jem lives in a town with Nessa, who is Ray's ex-partner. They weren't married, but they were ex-partner. And when Ray decided to go into isolation, and it was a decision he made into isolation, he left behind Nessa, who was pregnant with their son at the time. And so Jem, in the end, married Nessa and brought their son Brian up as his own boy. Although Brian obviously knows that Ray is his father. So when we meet them, it's obvious that something catastrophic has happened within their family. You know, Jem is praying. He goes downstairs. There's a really, really big air of gloom around the house. And you don't know what's happened initially, but you just know something really, really awful has occurred. Nessa presses an envelope into his hand. There's not a lot of dialogue between them, but there's a lot of emotion between them. This is obviously something neither of them were prepared for, but they're brave enough to step up and do whatever is necessary. And what's necessary in this moment is for Jem to go find Ray.
Okay, let's take something from the film. This is Sean Bean as Jem urging Daniel Day-Lewis's Ray to have a more sympathetic view of their dad.
My dad prayed for you too. Every day for the rest of his life.
If you've gone soft, that miserable bastard. Oh, he prayed. He prayed, didn't he? Prayed every time he took his belt off. Didn't he pray again afterwards? Wet under the arms from the efforts of his labour, or he prayed regular. We learnt our violence from the number one regional champion, and he had some stiff competition.
Declan, for you, you felt the film was a little bit stagey?
So it's kind of told in two parallel storylines, as Arlene says. Part of it is set in Sheffield, where Nessa is having these conversations with Brian, their son, who's played by Samuel Bottomley, and she's trying to persuade Brian that his father Ray is not a bad person for abandoning him. I mean, Brian has never seen his father abandoning Brian before he was even born. Brian, we learn, is a lost soul, is the description that's used. He's himself British Army and has gone AWOL and has been involved in a very, very serious fight. he needs the discipline, he needs the direction of Ray. The other storyline then is Jem tracking Ray down in the forest and trying to persuade him to come back to Sheffield to step up to be eventually and belatedly a father. Quite static. It just shifts between two kind of claustrophobic settings. A lot of interiors, a lot of two people sitting opposite one another talking. There are at least three significant monologues, all of them delivered by Daniel Day-Lewis, which takes the edge off that. But it does kind of contribute to that idea of a sense of a kind of a stage-bound and quite a static production. That's how it felt to me.
You're nodding quite a lot, Arlene.
Well, yeah, because first of all, the monologues, they're some brilliantly snarling, cracking monologues. But, I mean, the whole point of a monologue is that it comes from something, either a rage or some great emotional moment within that person. But he's playing opposite Sean Bean, and a lot of Sean Bean's reactions in this movie is just to sit there with a kind of hangdog expression on his face. So there's no fire back and forth between the two men, really. There's no sense of urgency or drama or rage. You know, there's rage in Ray, of course. But, you know, Jem also came up in the same school and with their father as well. And he, you know, he should have something of the same, if not rage, but vim and vigour. You know, he's an ex-squaddy. He was a tough guy when he was a kid. You know, there's a whole piece about, you know, Ray's talking about, there's a thing about being abused by a priest. And, you know, he said, oh, he never went near you because, you know, you're a hard guy even then. But you don't get that sense from Jem that he was a hard guy ever, because he has got such little dialogue and so little to work with.
It may seem obvious, but given that Daniel Day-Lewis is the co-writer here, has he given himself all of the best lines?
He has the best lines. I don't know whether he's given himself the best lines, but he has the best lines. I mean, even Samantha Morton. I love Samantha Morton as an actress. A lot of people would know Samantha Morton very well, but she has very little to do here either, apart from go around in oversized, dull clothes and look like really sad, eating crisps a lot and staring into space a lot. You know, I feel that they could have been given a lot more and they would have made this a much tighter production.
Okay, let's take something else from it. This is a scene where Jem and Ray lay down to sleep outdoors, and Jem is wondering how Ray survives in the harsh wilderness.
Now, did you... The winters, I mean, the isolation.
How did I what? How did I manage without you? It's not over, Jem. I'm gonna make it sound as if it... Yeah, I won't pretend I don't think about it from time to time, but this is it, Jem. This is my life.
Was it after me?
Point taken, Arlene. Okay. Declan, how important are the Troubles in this story?
Very, very significant. The actual film opens over the credits, the camera kind of panning left to right over these very crude children's crayon drawings of depictions of the Troubles, including Bloody Sunday. And immediately it's a very somber mood that's created. And we sense, once we hear that Ray is ex-British Army, that it's likely that he served in Northern Ireland, which is the case. He had some very traumatic experiences in Cross Midlen, particularly. And it does root Ray's trauma, but although there are multiple traumas, but it does root Ray's trauma, and it almost gives me a plausible reason for why he would abandon his family, because what he went through, the actions that he engaged in, were sufficiently traumatic to cause a man to want to abandon him, you know, society and civilization for the wilderness.
Okay, let's get some stars from you, Declan.
Look, it's brilliant to have Daniel Day-Lewis back, and he is terrific, but the storyline itself isn't strong enough to bear the burden of all the traumas that the character of Ray is asked to. So it's 3 stars for me.
Arlene?
I gave it 2. I really liked what Daniel Day-Lewis did, but the pacing was all over the place. I didn't think much of the plot, and, you know, I really thought, you know, the other characters were let down quite a lot by not what they said, but what they didn't have to say.
Okay. That is an M&E, just to remind you that Earlier this week, we talked to Daniel Day-Lewis and Ronan Day-Lewis about making the film, and you can listen back to that in all of the usual places. Next, Die My Love. Lynn Ramsey is the director. It stars Jennifer Lawrence as Grace, a new mum in rural Montana, but things start to unravel for her pretty quickly. Arlene, you've been suffering aftershocks from the film. You had a slightly throbbing headache when you came in.
I had a headache when I left. It was a stress headache because it is a stressful film. It's really, really good. It's very powerful. It is seen through a very female as Lynn Ramsey is the director, and she has a very strong grasp of what it is to stand on shifting sands, your mentality, when your mental state stands on shifting sands, you know. And what happens here is Grace and Jackson is played by Robert Pattinson. They move from a very busy New York to rural Montana. They're moving into a pretty old ramshackle cottage that was owned by Pattinson, or by Jackson's uncle, who we find out very quickly shot himself in the ass. I think we're allowed to say that.
And you already have.
Well, I won't say it again, but that's what happened to him. And so there's already there's an element of kind of craziness to it. But, you know, like, he's kind of like the crazy ghost over it all. And they're very happy. They're very in love. They're both creatives. She's set to write a book, and, you know, he's a musician. And within a short frame of time, she discovers she's pregnant, and everything changes. Everything changes between their relationship. Everything changes between the energy between the two characters. It changes. She changes dramatically because as she becomes bigger and more pregnant, she stops writing. She doesn't write a word. It's not even like writer's block. It's like maternal block. That's it. Everything is encompassed in this pregnancy, and she does not do well because of this, because she's no longer her own person. She's just spiraling.
How does Lynn Ramsey deal with those changes then? Because there are psychological changes, Declan, there are physical changes, and Jennifer Lawrence is the one who has to make all of that believable.
Yeah, so Lynn Ramsey, what she does at the start of the film, for the first 40 minutes or so, when I was slightly unsure about what was happening, it's a series of scenes that are almost impressionistic in nature. So I got the sense that the Grace character was drifting along the margins of her own life. There was a narrative that was preordained for her, but now she's drifting around the side of it, and she's almost observing Jackson and her mother-in-law and father-in-law as they go about their lives. We see scenes with Jennifer Lawrence crawling on hands and knees as if she's prowling through the grass, hunting as a predator and that kind of thing. And it wasn't really gelling. But then as Grace's neurosis, the postpartum depression, really kicks in, suddenly the scenes become much more realistic in tone. And her experience, Grace's experience, it's as if we're seeing the world through her eyes now. Everything becomes kind of crystal clear. It's a very empathic portrayal of, and as Arlene says, this is not just a film about postpartum depression. This is about a woman who was suffering creative and sexual frustration as well. And it's a potent mix.
Okay, let's take something from the film. This scene has another young mother reaching out to Grace, played by Jennifer Lawrence, but Jennifer Lawrence's Grace is not in the mood.
So do you think you'll have another one?
Yeah, pregnant now.
Picking up twins.
What happened to your hands?
Oh, you should see the wall.
Yeah, I am. I have two kids, and two is a lot, if I'm being honest.
Seems like it.
Babies, though. Babies are hard. I don't think anybody talks about that enough.
It's all anyone talks about.
It changes you. I think I nearly lost my mind for the first 6 months.
When do you think you'll be getting it back?
You know, postnatal depression is so much more common than people think. What do you do for work?
I don't.
Oh.
I'm stuck between wanting to do something and not wanting to do anything at all.
Oh, hang on. Cheryl mentioned that you're a writer. That's cute. That must be nice, having something you can kind of squeeze around a bit.
Yeah, I don't do that anymore.
Why not? Stuck for inspiration? I'm sure it'll come back.
I can see both of the writers smiling at the
that's cute.
That's cute moment. Arlene, so Robert Pattinson, he's Grace's husband in this. He works away a lot. That compounds the situation, particularly after the birth of the baby. Tell me about how her perception of him changes, and what's his understanding of what's going on, if he has one?
it's hard to know exactly at first whether he's a good guy or a bad guy. That's what I thought at the start, you know, because they were obviously very young and they were very lustily in love with each other. They were very physical, very, very hands-on with each other. And then he has to work. He has to earn money and she's pregnant, so she can't do what she wants to do. She can't write. She's, you know, she's really, really trapped within the four walls of the house and her own mind. So he's away a lot working and she just imagines the worst thing. It's one of those weird shots as well. You don't know whether he's actually doing the things that she imagines him to be doing or that we get the sense that she feels that he's doing these things. So their relationship becomes very fraught because it's not the same as it was before. But it can't be the same as it was before. But because she's so fragile in herself, everything becomes much bigger for her because her world is so much smaller. Everything becomes bigger for her. Every small infraction becomes bigger. And he makes things 100% worse by bringing home a dog into the middle of her, the first few weeks of her baby being born.
I got very uncomfortable when the dog was brought in.
I nearly had to leave the cinema at one point, or just for a few minutes break because of the barking, which I know is designed to show how, because the baby is crying in one scene and the dog is barking in this off camera in another scene, and the two sounds together would make, especially if you're exhausted, if you have a newborn baby, you're getting up in the middle of the night to feed a newborn baby, you can't sleep. Your husband is passed out asleep in the bed next to you and doesn't hear the dog that he brought back to the house. Like that whole, there was a whole couple of scenes together like that with that dog constantly barking in the background that made my anxiety levels shoot straight to the roof.
What about performances in this, Declan?
Good ensemble cast, Rick. So we have Sissy Spacek and Nick Nolte playing the parents-in-law. And Nick Nolte, his character is Harry. He's suffering from dementia. So the character of Grace really kind of bonds with him, has an affinity with him because as her life is falling apart. I think Robert Pattinson was quite good in that. Is he a good guy? Is he not a good guy? Is he just a bit dense? But Jennifer Lawrence, I think, was brilliant. I mean, the blonde bombshell route could have been the easy path for her to take in Hollywood. She hasn't done that. She's taken some challenging roles over the year. Darren Aronofsky's Mother, for example. And here, I think it might be a career best performance from her. She really leans into the chaos of the character of Grace. And you know, she throws herself at the role and leaves herself very vulnerable and very open. And I think it's a really successful turn.
It stars.
4 stars from me, largely on the basis of Jennifer Lawrence's performance.
Arlene?
I gave it 4 out of 5. I thought it was absolutely terrific. I think she's amazing in it, and I think she could be up for an Oscar. She was that good. She was absolutely, she's a powerhouse in this.
Okay, we spoke to Lynn Ramsey earlier this week as well here on the programme about the film. You can listen back to that wherever you get your podcasts as well. Finally this week to Alan Bennett's comedy drama The Coral. It's a wartime tale set in a Yorkshire mill town. Young men are heading off to the front line while the dwindling Coral Society is steadfastly determined to stage Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius. The uncompromising choirmaster Dr. Guthrie is Ralph Fiennes. Declan, in The Coral, backdrop of the First World War, you've got Nicholas Hoynter as director, Alan Bennett as the writer. They're the partnership behind Lady in the Van and The History Boys and Madness of King George. Tell us about this.
So yes, the World War One is looming large over this story. Ralph Fiennes is begged to take over as choir master to a diminished choir, as you put it. But the choir and the village itself have issues with the character of Dr. Guthrie, because not only does he have, quote unquote, his peculiarities, he's a gay man. It's not a spoiler, we're told. We find that out quite early. But he's a Germanophile and he has lived in Germany, and he is has a passion for Bach and Mozart's Austrian, but he has a passion for the German composers. So when he kind of represents, or he is rather the lightning rod for this English patriotism that has swollen as a result of the war. And things get even a bit stickier, because when he is forced to do Elgar rather than Bach, they're supposed to do St. Matthew's Passion first, but then he's supposed to do Elgar. And he has the wheeze of what we're going to do is we're going to do Elgar's Dream of Gerontius as a kind of anti-war protest. That doesn't really go down well in 1916 in Yorkshire.
The ensemble cast, Arlene, there's a particularly fine, large one here. How good are they?
Well, if you see Roger Allam in anything, he's just marvellous. He plays it so brilliantly. He's a sort of senior member of the choral, and he would have always been their go-to chap for tenor. But he'd I want to be polite about it and say that he might not have the voice now that he had when he was a younger man. And so he's not necessarily, but he's the shoe-in because so many of the younger guys have been conscripted and have gone to war that he just naturally just sort of stays in place, even though he's not quite the best singer of the group. But he has a little backstory of his own. He's lost his own son in the war and his house has turned into a mausoleum, himself and his wife. She is completely bound up in grief. So the choral to him is everything. It is everything to him because it's all he has left that he can control in his life. So it's he goes from between kind of quite prickly. He keeps telling, you know, Dr. Guthrie to stop speaking in German, even if it's called for, like whatever the name of the song is. If it's a German song, he'll say it. And he's like, oh, keep your voice down, keep your voice down. So there's all this kind of back and forth between those two, which is terrific. And, you know, it's quite, they get the small town and village mentality brilliantly. When Dr. Guthrie comes to the choral, he announces that they're going to do auditions. And as you can imagine, this has ruffled the feathers of a few of the older hens because they would have already had their place in the choral. And they don't want to be singing next to every Tom, Dick and Harry because to fill up the numbers of the choral society, you have to allow people from all walks of life in. So that's kind of, that is a quite interesting thing. So the choral itself are quite interesting as a group.
What do you think Alan Bennett is trying to say in this, Declan, if anything?
I think he's using the choir as a society in microcosm, and as Arlene is talking about there, it's a time when the class barriers are coming down, which I think is a great idea. It's a great vehicle. Unfortunately, we get characters saying things like, the class barriers are coming down, which is, you know, a touch on the nose, as it were. And I was kind of surprised by Alan Bennett. What he has tried to do, like, so the subplot involving Roger Allam that Arlene has just explained, multiply that by about eight. There's eight or nine other characters who also need to have their stories explained and their backstories brought into the foreground. Now, they are all interwoven, but when you have that many characters jostling for the front row, it's inevitable that none of them are going to get, you know, investigate it to a sufficient depth.
And you don't invest in them because of it, because you don't have time to invest in them. You don't have time to grow, to have feelings about their concerns, because as soon as you start investing in one character, you're bumped along straight away into a different character, you know, and there's just so much going on. There's, you know, there's romances starting and young men coming back from war that had assumed to be dead. And then, you know, Roger Allam's, you know, his wife is obviously going through some terrible, terrible breakup, and there's issues with hotels and then there's a almost subplot of a gay relationship between the pianist and Dr. Guthrie, which is turned down. There's just so much going on.
And then Elgar turns up.
And then Elgar rocks up in the middle of it in a Rolls Royce.
Okay, how many stars are we going for here, Arlene?
I'm giving it 2 out of 5. It's a really good cast here, and I'm kind of sorry to give it 2 out of 5, but to me it was like the Downton Abbey of war movies. You know, everything had such a light sheen and gloss over it, and I'm sorry in a way because, you know, if they had been a bit bolder, it would have been a better film.
Okay, Declan?
I liked it better than that, I think, and I think Ray Fiennes is terrific in this, and I'm told that his stiff upper lip is up for Best Supporting Actor next year. Very pleasant, solidly acted, not terrific. 3 stars for me.
Okay, before we finish this evening, we've just seen announced in the last hour or so that Shirley Valentine star Pauline Collins has died at the age of 85. Arlene, she was a formidable presence on screen for a while.
She really, really was. She was in so many things, but I only remember her, I don't know why, but I heard this coming in the car, and I just remember how scandalised people were by her back then in that film. You know, she walks up in a little bathing suit and she has an affair with, like, you know, Johnny Foreigner and all this kind of thing at her age. And she was so unapologetic about it. It was great. I loved her. I loved her for that. I loved her for just grasping her middle ages and going along and having fun. What a tribute she like for her. She was amazing.
I'd forgotten Declan until I read it in this piece, because it used to be on, I think, in the background when I was at home when I was a kid, that she was in the Liverbirds.
The Liverbirds, that's a real throwback. What I think Pauline Collins represents, there was a period in the 60s and the 70s in the UK where there was a great swathe of working class actors came through and were put front and centre on the big screen and the small screen, and that made a huge difference. And yeah, the Liverbirds is a classic example of that. We don't get to see that anymore. And it's a shame. And Pauline Collins is one of the kind of last great survivors of that era.
And that's Pauline Collins, the actress who's died at the age of 85. Arlene Hunt and Declan Burke, thanks very much as usual. And You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Composer and guitarist Bryce Dessner is widely recognised for bridging the worlds of classical and popular music. A founding member of the Grammy Award-winning band The National, he's also an acclaimed contemporary composer whose works have been performed by leading orchestras and soloists worldwide. And his film credits include The Revenant, The Two Popes and the upcoming Train Dreams. As artist in residence at the National Concert Hall for the 2024-25 season, Dessner has developed a close creative relationship with the National Symphony Orchestra Ireland. Tomorrow, that partnership culminates in the world premiere of Trembling Earth, a new cello concerto written for Anastasia Kopechkina and conducted by Andre de Riddler. The premiere also coincides with two major milestones for him, the release of his film score for Train Dreams and his receipt of the Samuel Beckett Medal from Trinity College Dublin for outstanding contributions to public discourse through the arts. Bryce Dessner, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the upcoming performance, congratulations on receiving the Samuel Beckett Medal. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's about?
Yeah, it's a medal from the Historical Society of Trinity called the HIST, which is a student group that's existed since 1770 and has included members such as Oscar Wilde and Samuel Beckett. So it was this kind of lovely honor that they invited me to come speak to their society today. The last two awards were given to Joan Baez and Patti Smith, so I was a bit humbled to be in that company. But yeah, it was a really wonderful opportunity.
That's a nice line to fall in. What did you say to the students when you spoke to them?
You know, I talked a little bit about my background and we had a, you know, question and answer kind of session. And I said just to, you know, often we're encouraged to focus and choose one thing in our lives. And I've kind of done the opposite. And I think that's what I told them today is like, you know, keep your interests, keep the diversity of your passions. And that defines who you are.
You've had a long relationship with the National Concert Hall there, here, but this performance feels particularly special. Thank you for allowing me to sit in on a little bit of the rehearsal today. It was wonderful. What does it mean to you to be premiering Trembling Earth in Dublin as part of the NCH residency?
It's been a really great year that I've spent. I think this is probably the fifth or sixth time I've been in town here in Dublin with the National Symphony Orchestra Ireland and the amazing team at the National Concert Hall, working on a variety of, you know, several of my major pieces, two other concertos, and really as a residency is a wonderful way to interact, especially with the musicians across a year, because often these contemporary pieces you get called in and you do a one-off and you never see them again. And it's kind of, who's this guy and what's this piece? And so to really be able to develop a relationship with the musicians and then to write for them. And a premiere is, it's like giving birth. It's a piece that took me the better part of the year to write. And then I had the musicians in mind, as well as Anastasia Kopechkina, who's the soloist, and Andre de Ridder, who's the conductor, who's an old friend of mine and an important collaborator. So, and to do it in Ireland, I always say, you know, Ireland is a country that's known for its poets and its painters and its musicians. It's not a, you know, we don't, it's, you know, culturally, its footprint in the world is massive, and it has one of the best music audiences in the world and a fantastically open and very talented orchestra. So the other commissioners on the piece are some of the, you know, most important orchestras in Europe. And so it's a wonderful, you know, to do the world premiere in Dublin was something that I felt like I could bring as part of the residency.
It was really interesting watching the last minute nudges being made by yourself and Andre, the conductor, today with the full orchestra. Is that the sort of thing that you like to do at this stage, just before a first performance of something?
You know, the written music, the manuscript, you know, working with 70 musicians on stage, you really need to show up with all your, you know, all your sentences finished and your, you know, T's crossed and whatever. You can't show up kind of without a very, very clear idea of everything that's going to happen. But the truth is the paint is still drying, and these pieces, while, you know, sometimes we relate to classical music as if it's some sort of, sure, if it's Bach or Mozart, it's like a sculpture in the garden. But in the case of contemporary music, for the musicians anyway, it's like they can't ask Bach questions or ask Mozart what he meant by mezzo piano in the third bar. But with a living composer, they can say, hey, man, what's this thing? So it's wonderful to get their feedback. And you know, I was making adjustments. And for me, you know, frankly, selfishly, doing this in Dublin, the orchestra is incredibly friendly and open. And so you have a real dialogue, a lot of interesting conversation and choices about sounds and articulation. And then going forward, I can incorporate that into the score. So I'll revise the piece based on what happens tomorrow night.
I want to know a little bit about the title Trembling Earth. It's very evocative. Where does that come from? And talk to us a little bit as well about the ideas that you're exploring in the concerto.
I was in Oslo last summer, and there was an exhibition of landscape painting by the well-known Norwegian painter Edvard Munch at the museum there dedicated to him. And there's a painting there called Trembling Earth. And, you know, we know Munch for the Scream and these paintings that are very iconic, kind of ushering in a lot of the trauma of the 20th century. But he was primarily a landscape painter. And they're just these beautiful, sort of colorful paintings of old oak forests in Norway. And like a lot of painters, I'm often influenced by work outside of music. So visual artists and poets and filmmakers, dancers, choreographers, I often find inspiration in kind of extra musical way. Trembling Earth, I found it was very evocative. There's another painter named Anselm Kiefer, a German painter, who there's a line of, he says, there's no such thing as an innocent landscape. And I think, you know, it's a landscape. It's a, you know, thinking about nature and kind of in this time that we're living through, which is a traumatic time of climate change and global conflict. And, you know, what I often, you know, I take walks in the woods with my son and I kind of think about the way that, you know, we live near a 700-year-old sort of oak forest, very, you know, ancient trees, and just thinking about the way the earth bears witness to the kind of human calamity and also to renewal. So that was, you know, it's not necessarily a political piece, but it's in there somewhere. It's kind of, you know, and there's a lot of emotion in the piece as well.
You wrote this for the cellist Anastasia Kobakina, but it's not the first time you've worked with her. So what drew you initially to her as a collaborator?
Anastasia Kobakina is a young cellist, like a kind of incredible virtuoso. She plays all the big pieces. She plays, you know, Dvorak and Elgar and the Schumann Concerto and Tchaikovsky and these, you know, Shostakovich, these sort of major, you know, classical works. But she's into Radiohead and listens to Aphex Twin and, you know, very curious about contemporary music. And she recorded two pieces for my recent solo record. Well, a record called Solos, which is unaccompanied instrumental pieces that were recorded for Sony Classical last year. And we worked together and she came into the studio. Oftentimes these pieces are very virtuosic and difficult and you edit them. And with her, she came in and we basically listened to a concert. She played it three times. And, you know, I think I used essentially one take. She's just phenomenal. And she's unbelievably open-minded and, you know, a lot of kind of purely classical artists can maybe struggle with some of the more American rhythms in my music, rhythmic, you know, something that say Irish musicians take easily can be difficult for artists coming from a more kind of purely classical background. She's the opposite. She just eats it alive. So, you know, it was these pieces I really write specifically for the soloists and the other concertos I've done as well. And so this piece is really, it's not a cello concerto. It's a cello concerto for Anastasia.
Yeah, let's listen to one of those pieces then from the album Solos. This is Song for Ainola. Thank you. That's Anastasia Kobakina from Bryce Dessner's album Solos. The concert also includes Ravel's Pavan and Beethoven's Eroica as well. Did hearing that Beethoven's Eroica would share the programme, did that spark any thoughts for you?
I mean, Beethoven's Eroica is his third symphony and was a kind of important moment in the history of music. I think people think of it as sort of the ushering a new era. And really what I can say about Beethoven is, like, he was the vanguard. You know, he was breaking the models and inventing instrumentation and kind of, you know, and so while we think of it as sort of the height of music for orchestra at the time, it was radical, you know. So it's always just the way Stravinsky was, or Ravel was as well, you know. So I think that to have a new piece, I always say, people ask, you know, why is there a new piece? It's like, well, you've heard Eroica a million times. It was written in 1803 or something. And it's like, but, you know, to hear my piece before it, whether you like it or not, Eroica will never sound the same. It gives a different doorway through which to walk in. You know, it's kind of like walking through the, you know, the modern art gallery and then into the Louvre or wherever it is. So it's always, I love, you know, I'm a student of this music and I'm in conversation with it. And so it's wonderful to hear what they'll do tomorrow night with Eroica.
We talked about film earlier. The score for Train Dreams comes out the same day as the premiere. It must be an exciting and maybe a slightly surreal juxtaposition for you.
Ironically, it's Train Dreams is based on a beautiful Dennis Johnson novel of that title. And it's a film, a very, you know, it's almost like a poem with music and images or something. It's a very, very minimal, very little dialogue, a lot of music, set in the American West, sort of turn of the century. So it actually shares, I would also say in terms of the film scores I've done, it shares some DNA with my concert music. So in a way, they're related. And I think, you know, while, you know, Trembling Earth, the new cello concerto tomorrow night for Anastasia Kobakina, is very virtuosic, Train Dreams has, there's something in there that it is in common. So I'm really proud of the work I've done on that score and very happy for the filmmakers and Joel Edgerton, who's the lead actor in the film, because it's doing well for him. And yeah.
After the performance, you're going to be joining Anastasia and Andre for a post-concert talk. What sort of conversation can audiences look forward to if they're going to be coming?
It's a great opportunity after the concert for, you know, people to hear more about the making of the work. And I think also Andre is one of my oldest collaborators. You know, we've worked together for many, many years. He's, you know, a close friend. And Anastasia is a more recent collaborator of mine in the last couple of years. So it's I think, really nice. Also generationally, I think Anastasia is in her late 20s or maybe 30. And Andre in his mid-50s, and I'm turning 50 this year. So I think it's, you know, interesting as well to, you know, in terms of perspectives on this music and on classical music. And as a kind of closer to the residency as well, I'm sure we'll talk with John Kelly tomorrow night about, you know, some of the experiences I've had.
I would be remiss if I didn't finish this conversation by asking you about the National and about whether or not there's something happening. Is there an album coming, or what's happening with the band?
The band still very much exists, and we are in touch, and there are, you know, talks about playing music together again soon. So I don't know that, I think it'll probably take more the form of just writing and getting in the same room at some point soonish. As far as touring, I don't know when that would be, but don't worry, the National will be back.
Bryce Dessner, thank you for joining us tonight on Arena.
Thanks, Rick.
The world premiere of Trembling Earth with the National Symphony Orchestra Ireland will be performed at the National Concert Hall tomorrow evening, Friday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. And there are full details on nch.ie. And you're listening to Thursday night's Arena. That's the band Poor Creature, Ruth Clinton, Cormac McDermida and John Dermody singing a song called The Whole Town Knows. They're just three of the many young folk musicians who feature in a new documentary, Utopa Celtic, or Celtic Utopia, about to screen at the Cork International Film Festival this weekend. The film is written and directed by Dennis Harvey and Lars Lovén, filmmakers based in Sweden. It's a portrait of modern Ireland through its younger folk musicians, artists like Summer Newman and Susan Hughes, Lancome and the Mary Wallopers, who both play music and give their views on the country's history and where we are now. I'm delighted that Dennis Harvey joins me now on the line from Stockholm. Welcome to Arena, Dennis.
Thanks very much for having me, Rick. How are you doing?
We'll get to the film in a moment, but you've been living in Sweden since 2017. So what took you there?
Yeah, like many people, love took me here. But I'm not together with my ex-partner anymore. But I sort of found my film people here and found my community. So I've stayed. And another big thing that brought me over was that the education is free here. So when you're making films, and I studied film studies, it's not a great idea to start your career by going into a load of debt doing a master's. So it was really, really nice that I could move here and study for 2 years doing my master's and not be in debt.
Okay, let's dig into the film. Utopa Celtic or Celtic Utopia. Where did that start as an idea for you?
It goes back to about 2019. It takes quite a while to make these sort of documentaries, and I was working in a production company in Stockholm, and just at the lunch table, me and Lars started talking a bit about what was going on in Irish music, because Lars is a music journalist, and he'd also made this brilliant film called Funko in different cities in Africa, and they were looking at sort of how young people were taking interesting like traditional melodies into electronic music in different cities, and that was sort of reflecting the post-colonial era where younger people were sort of reapproaching their history and culture. And so we were sort of talking a lot about that, and I was talking about what was going on politically in Ireland as well and musically, and we sort of realized that there was an interesting that we thought it'd be really interesting to approach Ireland from a post-colonial perspective, you know, which is maybe not particularly expected because it's a Western European country, but I think we found quite quickly that the musicians when we spoke to them were really interested in thinking about their music and Irish society and culture in this way. Like,
why the title Celtic Utopia? Where does that come from?
It was I was thinking about this earlier. Like, I mean, in a way, there's a sort of ironic nod to De Valera's, like a lot of like, we at the start of the process we were watching a lot of De Valera's or listening to a lot of De Valera's like early speeches in the sort of nation building era, and you know, there was this weird mix of like anti-imperial revolutionary zeal, conservative Catholicism, and then this sort of, you know, ancient Celtic history that was sort of weaved into it all. And so, but there was a real like ambition, at least for something, for a brighter future. But then obviously what became of Ireland in the 50s, obviously I didn't live through it, but like the 50s up to the sort of 90s was like a very repressive and sort of dark society. So we did have a sort of slight, like ironic glint in the eye with calling it Celtic Utopia, but actually then, you know, having gone through the years of meeting the musicians and following them around and hearing how they really think very ambitiously about what society can be in Ireland and demand something better. So ultimately, I think that there is it's not just an ironic sort of nod that De Valera, there is some sort of utopian aspiration with the film.
Okay, I want to do this now because on one level, the film is a fantastic showcase for the younger folk scene in Ireland. Let's hear a little bit of Summer Newman.
Born on a mountain 600 years ago, I traveled these hills and valleys through the rain and snow. Heard the lightning flash, seen the thunder roll. I've endured, I've endured. How long can one endure? Barefoot in the summer, running through the fog. Too many mouse feed, they couldn't hold us all. Trip to church on Sunday, learn the golden rule. I've endured, I've endured. How long can one...
And that's called I've Endured by Summer Newman. Tell me a little bit about how you went about finding the lesser known musicians in the documentary. How did you decide who to include?
Yeah, so well, it's great. It's lovely that you play Summer there because... like as you can hear, Summer's from the US, but she was at like we were filming a session with the Mary Wallopers at Negro Impacto, and Tig and Alfie Mulligan, in Dundalk, and like, so I think Summer is friends with some with the Hendy brothers in the Mary Wallopers, and was there, and you know, we were like, it was mainly Irish tunes that we were filming, but then Summer played that, and we were just absolutely blown away. Like and that was sort of, that was the process with a lot of the film as well, where we had like a certain amount of musicians who like, I'd been listening to a lot of people like Jinx Lennon and the Deadlians for a long time, and TPM, what the Hendy brothers did before they started the Mary Wallopers. And so when we went and filmed with them the first time, then they'd recommend other people to us. You know, they'd be like, "Oh, check out Bratman, she's doing amazing stuff," or you need to meet like Ruth, who's in Poor Creature, and then another band called Landless as well. So there was a nice sort of organic development of just meeting more and more artists through being sort of in and around the scene. And we filmed, like, I mean, there's 22 artists, I'm pretty sure, in the film, bands or artists in the film, and like, we, there's probably another 25 that we filmed with who we absolutely could have included. Like, this, some of our favorite performances we just couldn't find space for in the edit, so we filmed. Yeah, there's such an amazing, healthy, vibrant scene.
There's that moment where about two-thirds of the way through the documentary, you head north and the film shifts a gear. One of the characters you meet is a loyalist rapper called Young Spencer. Who's he?
Yeah. So Young Spencer, Gareth Spence, he's from the Shankill Road, from the loyalist tradition. But he's someone who's like incredibly. Like, he's really, really determined to bring the communities together. Like, very much, he speaks about it in the film. He sort of said when you're growing up, like, he was sort of told to, like, the curbs are either red, white, and blue, or green, white, and orange. And he's sort of told to hate those on the other side of the wall. And he's really just like, well, why? Like, I don't agree with that. And it was amazing. So he supported NECAP in December last year in Belfast, and like at their headline gig, and he said it was this incredible feeling, in his own words, to have 9,000 Fenians screaming his name back to him in support. He's a really amazing character, and we actually found him again when we were filming in Dublin with Sinead Kennedy and Alan Woods, two great people in the trad scene in Dublin. And Alan just showed us a video of Young Spencer that he was watching on YouTube at the time. A song called "Straight Out of Belfast" went a bit viral, and it's a mad song. But we were really interested in Young Spencer, because like I'd never met someone my own age who was you know, from the loyalist tradition. It was an amazing thing. It just felt like a really interesting and important thing that when we were going north, that we should try to include someone from a different tradition when we're trying to speak about the whole island. We were determined to sort of think about the island as an island and not really recognize partition.
Yeah, and this is a lovely moment from the film that you capture. It's Young Spencer, and he's talking to a bunch of kids who are hanging out at their local KFC.
Only on once, KFC for a month. Probably down to like our last £4. God.
The league gets fucked on KFC now for £4.
But that's really like, when you talk about, do you know what I mean? The next ones, it's all lemons, like, do you know what I mean? They're out all day. Like, a lot of times the streets raise you here, you know what I mean? Like, you spend so much time outside, you forget what inside looks like. Right, here's a question, boys. Think about Belfast, right? What would you say is the best thing about Belfast? And there's no wrong answer, like, any answer can be right or wrong. So you reckon people, like, right? So what do you think's the worst thing? Bingo.
We're fighting for nothing.
My mate, stretch for a fist bump.
Dennis, what do you want the film to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question, like, but I suppose, like, something I always think with my films, that, like, film is a very good way of sort of creating and building human connection, you know, across like disparate or different experiences. And so, I think, you know, there's a we're living in a time when like there's a real, there's a lot of darkness in politics, and there's a huge like rise of nationalism and sort of ethno-nationalism. And I think in Ireland, like when we were filming first, when we started filming, the sort of ethno-nationalism hadn't caught on as much in Ireland, but what's sort of risen in Ireland, I think, has way more to do with like Tommy Robinson in the UK than like Tommy Potts, you know, or like an Irish legend. So I think with this film and with this scene, we sort of determined to document this. There's like a real embrace of Irish culture, and like a, you know, people are looking back, looking inwards, and learning Irish again, and picking up trad instruments that they maybe had like shunned in the past, and that's amazing, and that should be celebrated, and as well because there's a real determination, I think, in the scene as well to open things up. Like no one is stuck in ways of who is Irish or who can be Irish or what is Irish music. There's a real progressive, inclusive sort of urge in the scene, and so I suppose I hope the film can can sort of play a role in that, in opening up and what ideas of what Irishness is and what like Ireland can be.
Well, it's a fine piece of work. Congratulations on it, and I hope it gets the wide audience it deserves.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it. Yes, I hope we see people at the premiere in Cork this weekend.
Dennis Harvey, one of the co-directors of Celtic Utopia, thanks for joining us on Arena tonight. The screening is at 5:30 this Saturday, the 8th of November, at the Everyman in Cork, and you can find more details at corkfilmfest.org. And that is it for tonight's Arena, produced by Sinead Egan. Paula Shields was our researcher. Ollie Hamilton, the broadcast coordinator, and sound supervision tonight by Mark Dwyer. I'll talk to you again tomorrow night from 7 o'clock. John Creedon is after the news.